Welcome everybody to today's event. My name is Elena Fidian-Kasmir and I'm the principal investigator of the Southern Responses to Displacement Research Project, which is co-hosting this event with the UCL Institute of Advanced Studies. Today's roundtable is part of a broader process which will lead to the publication of a series of written reflections by our panelists in a forthcoming special issue of the Open Access Journal of Humanitarian Affairs. And the aim of today's event is to be part of a dynamic and ongoing conversation on the important questions of the future of refugee-related research and of humanitarianism. And this includes critical engagement with regards to the increasing discourse, if not practice, of decolonizing humanitarianism. But of course, noting that such critical forms of engagement long predate that trendy topic of decolonization. Our contributors will be drawing on diverse and important experiences, including as academic researchers, as people who have themselves been researched, as responders, including teachers with refugee backgrounds, and former humanitarian practitioners with large NGOs. I won't read out their bios here, but their bios will be posted in the chat box as they speak, and you can also find more information about each of our speakers online on the link that will follow. So our speakers have been invited to bring conversation starters for the group with a view for the event to involve listening to and responding to one another in the spirit of solidarity, including the potential for productive discomfort and productive forms of disagreement and debate. I might interject with a question, whether my own or from the audience, if you add any questions in the chat box. But otherwise, I'll be stepping back now, and I'm very much looking forward to the conversation, as I'm sure that you are all too. So thank you very much and welcome.
So shall I start us off? So the question that I've been, I guess, grappling with is around, relates to what extent and to what effect is the decolonization of humanitarianism and refugee-related research meaningful or tokenistic? And I'm happy to share a couple of thoughts, and of course my colleagues will come in with their own reflections around this. And I know today we're going to hear there are multiple opportunities to support non-hegemonic ways of producing knowledge. But from my perspective, one of the issues is for the vast majority of institutions or organisations, the will beyond a performative kind of superficial level isn't there. In 2020, with the momentum around Black Lives Matter and COVID-19, we all saw humanitarian and academic institutions release pledges, conduct unconscious bias trainings, reshuffle their boards. We saw them begin to use terms like decolonizing or release statements about complicity in upholding colonial values. But 2 years on, I'm not convinced the majority of institutions that their day-to-day operations have changed. And when we look at like humanitarian research, particularly when connected to INGOs, it's often positioned to maintain systems and structures with a designated role in ensuring renewed funding. Furthermore, most research processes, be it an INGO-led evaluation, an institutional grant, a PhD doctoral study programme, or donors' preset log frame indicators, are often designed without people most affected by a humanitarian crisis being in the room. We also know that the people who are in the room are often coming from privileged socioeconomic demographics within their context. So that's to say that people often designing these agendas have limited first-time hand experience of social inequity. So although whilst it's promising that there is this kind of growing body of critical humanitarian inquiry, the majority of scholarship that seeks to define decolonizing aid is not being generated by people who are at the margins, but instead by those who are part of maybe the academic or NGO apparatus. So I'll stop there and see if anyone wants to come in and add to that.
Thank you, Jess. I'm happy to jump in if that is okay. I think, Jess, like our research, and I work very closely here with Giselle and other colleagues in Latin America, I think we share some of the reflections that you put forward, not only in relation to the decolonization agenda, but also in relation to the localization of Southern research. And I think we can see certain parallels in the discourses there. For us, and I want to bring it to localization, but I will relate it later on to discussion of decolonization. We raise a couple of questions. First is that who determines who is the local in this context, and which is a question that we think is very intertwined, not only the question, but the answer to it as well, to who shapes these agendas, also the agendas of decolonization that have taken, particularly a couple of years ago, you know, the academic spaces here in the UK as well. And not only who shape it, but also with what purposes and under which terms. And while the call of localization might in some cases have some good intentions, some initiatives really fall short in really promoting, you know, a Southern localized knowledge, or really to engage with actors that go beyond the traditional ones. And I know that Elena has also raised this in particular, you know, related with national and regional levels mostly. So for us, the question is like, really, who is the local? And in many cases, the local is not necessarily that one that knows the field the best, but actually those ones that are able to translate locality to Northern, mostly English-speaking actors. And that's not necessarily, you know, decolonized academy, bringing people to the table without giving, you know, the space to shape the agendas and not really decolonizing refugee research or humanitarianism in general. And this is like English-speaking actors really are the ones that are kind of selected for those who control the funding and who allocate the resources. So the exercise ended up being a bit of a rhetorical because we approach, you know, the local to select the right interlocutor within a particular space. That for us is not necessarily localized research. Instead, it becomes an instrumentalization of the local. And when the colonial or the Southern or the local approaches are really designed, articulated and shaped by Northern actors, both academia and, you know, within international organization, it already comes with a particular gaze that doesn't necessarily unsettle the structure upon which it's produced. So this the same happened with discourse of decolonization, particularly in the context that Giselle and I work in Latin America, but really reproduce the same practices, the same knowledges, the same ideas under a particular banner that aims for validation. Now, the second problem we see is also more practical because when some of the Southern voices are included to share their experiences, there are very much issues in order to participate in presence in some of these spaces. And we see even if within Latin America and some of the conference, one of the last one that is a big one in the region in Claxo that took place in Mexico, many colleagues from other countries of Latin America couldn't even access because they didn't got visas or they got a stop at, you know, at the checkpoint, particularly, you know, with racialized grounds. But we said the same in the context of the UK, no? We want to work and promote with colleagues in the South, but really we don't have the structure, the visas to allow us to join us in these spaces. So we feel that, you know, when it's really a banner and it's just like the commodification of the marketization of the colonial localization approach, it really falls short in what it's attempting to do. I will leave it there in the meantime. Any other colleague that would like to jump in?
Picking up on the notion of racialization, Patricia, could you please play the first extract? So this also notes, links up with Marcia's point about inclusion and exclusion. So Marwan is one of our contributors for the roundtable with Jess, but unfortunately the connection from Juba is very difficult. So thankfully he's been able to share a pre-recorded audio presentation with us, which we can't play in its entirety, although it will be available as a podcast online afterwards. So we're just going to listen to one short extract in which Marwan is reflecting on racial ambiguity in the context of humanitarian response. So thank you, Patricia, for playing that for us.
But most of it, challenges outweigh all. And I wanted to actually discuss little challenges I've actually encountered and as from the point of experience. That where I think the humanitarian agencies and then the academicians should actually emphasize and put the effort to rectify and actually improve these such issues. On the first issue here, I wanted to talk about racial ambiguity. In literal meaning, it refers to a person whose racial background is not easily identifiable. And we are saying racially ambiguous people are always individuals who are frequently misidentified racially. You really take, for example, people fleeing their country as a displaced person and then running to a third country of choice or second country where you really want to seek for refuge. And again, you realize the host community, the humanitarian organizations coming on the ground also, sometimes when they don't address you it's like they have never understood who you are, actually. And the host community, actually, some of them misunderstand who a refugee is. They begin to see, to be called a refugee, it's like you are from a different race. You are not like a fellow colleague. You are not like a fellow human being, you see. They begin to actually make you look identifiable, and you feel like you are so different. Humiliation, stigma become part of you, and then you feel like, why only me? And this actually is always has happened to actually individuals who are actually displaced. Not far from me, as one of the person who has 3 years being displaced from a country to another country as a refugee. And this also forced me to say that a race is perceptibly ambiguous, and stigma is assigned, and normativity is imposed through discursive constraint or any other means. And therefore, racially ambiguous individuals use many forms of resistance to navigate this encounter and make identity claims that either affirm or endanger the normativity of the racial formation order. So you realize some of us are refugees or displaced persons. We always feel like, who are we then if we are not given what we feel like we need? If we find that people around me, people have come to us a visitor, always don't receive me, and then I always feel like I'm really from a different planet. You see, it's like where I come from, they don't know that these people always exist, this country exists, these communities exist. And then they always, you always look like you are not being identified who you are. And that is where racial ambiguity actually comes in as a concept and as a challenge to people who are actually displaced. And as academicians or intellectuals, we need to really create awareness and educate people on how to actually eradicate such error when it comes to misidentifying people or judging people without actually knowing who they are. Because some of other people begin to even say it is because of your mistake, that's why I forced you to leave your place. But actually, we always know conflict doesn't tell when it happens. And you may not know who to cause conflict, but you'll always only realize that you are a displaced person.
Can I come in? And I agree with some of the points that have been raised. But that just because decolonization is not going on within institutions, it doesn't mean that we as academic researchers can't push for change. One, we should push for, we should think about our research priorities. We should think about the language we use, the categories we use to name people or to even name them into being, as our previous speaker was talking about, in the sense that we create these categories of displaced. The category of displaced people is a humanitarian category created purely for the purpose of managing people. So what's our goal? I mean, what we've seen in the contemporary period, neoliberalism's anti-welfareism, we've seen the rise of populist and anti-democratic forces that are really hostile to humane practices, to migration, to refugees. And I think what that's done is to expose the false narratives that sustain the post-war state humanitarian regimes, that humanitarian agencies are there to do good, right? And therefore, that means that we have to be even more critical, even within our spaces. And I'm thinking about how MESSA uses the term the boomerang effect to talk about, in some sense, the impact of colonialism, the dehumanization practices of colonialism on the colonized. But also, he argues that it rebounds and impacts the colonizers themselves. And I think as researchers, right, we have to be aware. COVID-19 actually shows us that it's possible for nations, people anyway in the global north or states, to sacrifice their people, right, for an economic gain or for other reasons. But they're not, in some sense. What we can see is Mbembe's concept of necropolitics becoming quite a reality in places where we didn't assume it was a reality. So we need to take action. If we are it's not just refugees, us and them. Refugees are very much part of us and how we are likely to be treated. So even on an instrumental, using an instrumental argument like that, I think it's important for us to actually address racism and racialization. My colleague Amber Murray and Nick Jackson have written a really interesting paper, which was published in the Association of American Geographers Journal, which was about local washing, you know, following on from what Marcia was saying about how, you know, international agencies now local wash development projects by bringing in local people, by using images of local people, when in fact the same processes, the same actions are in play. So I think we need to think about what research priorities. What questions do we ask? Where do we start our research from? That's genuinely decolonizing. Do we start from the refugees? Do we start, or do we start from the development agency? Right. And we might not always. I mean, I know we're reliant on funding, and we might not get funding for such projects. But I think the more of us starting to do that, the better it will be, and the more likelier we are to see shifts. Anyway, I'll stop there. I can say more later.
Well, can I just maybe go back to that point and compliment what the colleagues have been saying here on how basically humanitarian agencies have been reproducing these discourses, these colonial discourses. What we've seen here from our research through this group that Marcia mentioned coming out, those efforts in some cases to decolonizing humanitarianism are in existence. When we were doing research here in the past 2 years during the pandemic to try to find out what the impacts of the pandemic had been on the well-being of migrant and refugee populations in Latin America, what we saw was basically a new assemblage of factors, which includes an increase in more protagonic role of international organizations, such as the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the International Organization for Migration, and other UN bodies, as well as, of course, CSOs, civil society organizations, local and international ones. And what we saw was that the increased role of these organizations, particularly during the pandemic, not only contributed to basically increasing the disengagement of the state with the people in their territories, but also kind of contributed to the production and reproduction of ideas, resources, and funding structures that are basically key to Western humanitarianism and interests, political interests. And that basically at the end contribute to this subjectification of migrant and refugee populations as humanitarian subjects, who, as we argue in a paper that we actually publish in comparative migration studies, that are then not only entitled to emergency assistance, or better, are only entitled to emergency assistance in a context, in a framework where their presence is basically rendered temporary. And along with that, maybe I'll leave that for the rest of the discussion, has to do with actually how some refugee-led organizations are leading the way in resisting to these dynamics and these movements in the region.
Did you want to come in, Yusuf?
Yes, thank you. And just to add to this very dynamic conversation, as someone who I would say perhaps I position myself as in the past, of course, somebody who's been researched and now as currently a researcher, I think that this positionality itself perhaps complicates things even further. I think that Patricia did say about or did touch on naming and how this name sort of should be written into being. And I do feel, as somebody who was born and raised in a camp in Lebanon, how humanitarianism is at times reduced to the name, in fact, of the donor. And how I still remember, I think that Elena, I'm sure that she still remembers this conversation with one of the researchers in Badawi camp, where he was mainly recounting an interview that he conducted with some Syrian refugees who not long ago received aid from, I believe, from a charity or an organization from the Gulf, from the Arab Gulf. And how this recipient was talking about the logo being inscribed on, in fact, the logo of this organization on his blanket. And that as he was tossing and turning, trying to fall asleep, that he would see the logo of this organization from different perspectives and different angles. So much so that this logo has continued to exist, in fact, in his sleep. And I think that this is quite, I would say, perhaps relevant for us to think about how naming happens at the expense of the named, of those individuals who tend to receive aid, and how we're assumed that we are there to be researched and to be asked the questions. And of course, we should be grateful that we are being asked. Marwan did say that they don't know who we are. In fact, I have to add to this and say, at times we don't know who we are ourselves, because things, it's about... So it's the assumption that you're there. In fact, sometimes I hear it from my mother that you have to accept this position that you are as a refugee in a camp, that you're there to be researched and you're there to be interviewed and you're there to be recorded. And in response to that, I would like, and again, social science is not my field, but I would like to recite a poem which comprises, in fact, two sections on our encounters with mainly anthropologists. Of course, I have friends who are anthropologists who tend to come to the camp, but also they don't understand that research should not encompass, in fact, the very existence of people. And the title of this piece is Anthropologists. I know some of them. Some of them are friends, but the majority are enemies. Upon the doorstep, you observe what they observe with a lot of care. You look at them the way they look at you, curiously and obliquely. You suddenly develop a fear of imitating them whilst they imitate you. You worry about relapsing into one of your minds while sharing mundane details with them. Sometimes I dream of devouring all of them, and just once, with no witnesses or written testimonies. All of us wanted to greet her, even my illiterate mother, who never spoke a word of English, said welcome after spending hours with us in the same room. She left with a jar of homemade pickles and a threefold cassettes with our voices. I think that again, it's about sort of capturing the voice, but at the same time, overlooking, in fact, the silent, perhaps pain and discomfort that those who are being researched tend to hide.
Can I just jump in here and just to thank Joseph also to shed the light into academia and researcher as part of a humanitarian machine. We are also part of migration industries in particular way. And what I found very interesting is also not only how we negotiate that, you know, in terms of being part of the industry that we also criticize, but also how our research participants negotiate with us as well, those same terms. And that made me think and picking up as well the point that Gisela made in terms of refugee and migrant-led organizations, particularly in the context of Latin America. We have seen very strongly how they have been claiming that not being talked about them without them. And they make that point very strongly all the time. And this is not recent, of course. We have seen a tradition, you know, of migrant refugee-led organizations in the context of Latin America since the Peruvian, you know, refugees displaced in the 90s, then the Colombian displaced in the 2000s, and now with the Venezuelan displaced as well. And they are different. They have different political positions and they come from different places as well, which facilitate or, you know, or create tensions with certain structures of powers that they want to negotiate. So they are not a monolithic, you know, group either. They are very heterogeneous. But if you allow me, the point that you read to us, you said, and thank you for sharing, it reminds me of a particular group of refugees in Latin America, and Gisela might know this very well, is the group of Palestinian resettled refugees that went to Brazil and some to Chile in the 2007-2008. And there's one particular group of Palestinian refugees that arrived to Brazil that they protested outside the offices of the UNHCR for more than 9 months, claiming that they didn't want it to be there. That they, you know, because resettlement is, of course, a voluntary option for the refugee, you know, and it's a discretionary measure imposed by the states, taken by the states, but they actually said that the information wasn't clear and they really wanted to claim the role of being, you know, a refugee. So there's a very beautiful book chapter that our colleague Carolina Molan wrote a few years ago that talk about this idea of the ungrateful subject and how they negotiated that they came to Brazil with all the press, you know, with all this information around, with all this campaign of the UNHCR in Brazil being so generous in Latin America. And they were like, we are not ungrateful with, you know, Brazil. We are just claiming our right to be citizens, you know, citizens of the world, that we have been displaced historically. I'm trying to find the quote, I will put in the chat when I find it. It came to me when you said you were talking, but I found that very interesting in terms of we talk about decolonizing research or, you know, localized research and the role that refugee population is claiming there. What I wanted to highlight is not only how they negotiate with, you know, the humanitarian industry at large in the face of international organizations, but also how they negotiate with us as well, as academics and researchers, that we are part of the same industry. If I find the quote, I'm just trying to open files in the meantime, I will put in the chat to share with you. Thank you.
Jess, did you want to come in?
Yeah, sure. And I'm holding my phone here because Marwan's actually joining us via WhatsApp. So if anyone wonders why I'm holding this at the screen. So many really interesting points. Maybe to build on this point, Marcia's points about the research industrial complex or the INGO industrial complex and this idea that actually we are all kind of involved and complicit in multiple industries that have multiple interests in this system. It made me think of this really brilliant paper that I read recently by, I think it's Gauthier Marchas, Pauline Bazouzi and Amiable Lameke, called The Data is Gold and We Are the Gold Diggers, Whiteness, Race and Contemporary Academic Research in Eastern DRC. And they really talk about, from the perspective of the demand for quantitative research in Eastern DRC and how this has created a kind of industrial complex, but there are very implicit hierarchies in people's different roles and the different value that is placed on somebody who's a data collection as opposed to somebody who's maybe a research associate or someone who's a principal investigator. And I think one of the points they make is that whether or not it's explicit, the research industrial complex, or the humanitarian industrial complex in this case, really does rely on this kind of racial regime of hierarchy, or racial regime that kind of that profits from inequality. And it kind of links to kind of Patricia's point, where she talks about our roles and thinking about our roles in this research industry and what we can do to, I guess, kind of minimize these ways of working that ultimately disenfranchise so many people, and thinking more about this kind of constructive complicity then. So if we are involved in these apparatuses, if we are working the humanitarian aid system or in, you know, institutions, what are we doing to mitigate that in our practice? How are we using our kind of privileges, our positionalities, to kind of leverage and make those small pushes for change, without kind of co-opting this label or idea of decolonizing, which again is very much rooted in struggle and redistribution of wealth.
Yeah. Picking up on this, I'm going to suggest to Patricia, that we play the second extract from Marwan's podcast, the entirety of which will be available to listen to online. I'm very sorry, Marwan, that you're having to listen to us through WhatsApp from Jessica's phone because of the barriers that exist. But Marwan, amongst other things, offered some really interesting reflections as well on inequality on financial levels in the humanitarian industry as well. So over to Marwan.
Another challenge on this point, I also want to talk to us, patterns of inequality as being one of the major also challenge in this regard. This pattern of inequality is actually, actually also tried to subdivide it into two, where we look at inequality in form of gender and also in form of classes. And we're saying this give broad trends in patterns of inequalities, especially when I talked of classes, like the wages and expenditure. And this also goes to the regards of the staffs. As a teacher in the refugee context, I've taught in many countries where I've been to as a refugee. And you find that all of you might be teachers. No wonder even some of us may all have big positions, administrative positions, and then or maybe being overloaded with work, lesson plan, scheme of work. And then at the end of the day, when salaries come, you are told that a refugee salary scale is also different from the host community teachers. And in some point, even the refugees are the one carrying the heavy load because we are trying to help our fellow refugee children. But again, you find that you are not paid equally just because they call you as a refugee. And that always created a gap in me, and I always feel like I'm traumatized. I'm so much stigmatized. Why, if we deliver the concepts in class, if we always do lesson planning, if we always do the scheming of work, we approach the same methodology of learning and teaching. And then at the end of the day, the benefits, the compensations, actually is not given equally as all of you teachers, but it is given based on who you are called to. And I see that being part of inequality, actually, when it comes to wages and expenditure. And I really call in that we as intellectuals and humanitarian agencies, we really need to see how we can address such concepts. Being called a refugee doesn't mean that you are not able to deliver. Some of us can deliver better. But again, when it comes to compensating the hard work, it is always given along the line of the classes of people, being a refugee and being the host community. And I saw so it was actually... if we really want to see how we can address it and put it in the proper context. Under pattern of inequality, I also look at gender. You realize, based on our different cultural backgrounds and then our different contexts of areas, women are so much victimized. Yes, women are not given opportunities to be exposed to education. They are looked at like housewife materials. They only look like people who are supposed to be in the kitchen. Even if a degree holder, you are married, you keep your paper under a pillow. You see such experiences. And then as intellectuals and people whom we are trying to become the agent of change in the global context.
Thank you, Marwan. I'm sorry that we have to stop at that point. Who would like to come in and continue the conversation?
Can I say something about research methods, just following on from what Jess said? Because I also wrote a paper, actually ended up being a book chapter in the handbook, Routledge Handbook of Gender and Development. And the chapter is entitled, such a long time ago, Researching Sexual Violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Methodologies, Ethics, and the Production of Knowledge in an African Warscape. And the reason why I wrote that chapter was exactly because of what Jess was saying, what I was witnessing in the field, where the same techniques, the same care that goes into research, the care that goes into researching sexual violence in the West is not replicated in the Eastern Congo. And I mentioned the issue about numbers, but one of the techniques I heavily criticized, which was carried out by researchers, I think, in prominent institutions in the West, was going into the middle of a village, throwing a coin, going to the house, the direction in which the coin dropped, speaking to a woman about her experiences. Now, if you've been in an African village, you can imagine how terrible that must be, because the whole village, all the children would come around to listen, right? So there were lots of issues around, you know, about how you re-traumatize people in processes like that. The other issue was about they didn't even I was looking at studies in Chicago and other places where they would give poor women money for food and so on, and for traveling expenses and other things when they interviewed them. In Africa, they actually said no. It would just, you know, increase expectations of more money. And I thought that's really terrible. So I actually wrote this piece about how we need to think about, you know, the sort of research ethics that we apply, the methods and techniques we deploy, and just don't, because they dehumanize the people we speak to. They also increase the stigmatization if interviews are done often in the open or in particular places, and also how we represent that data. And I was really concerned about the images of these women, photographs and so on, that were reproduced in reports and available online. And now that everyone can access everything online with mobile phones, we have these women who probably want to move on and live their lives differently. Yeah, find themselves being constantly exposed through these humanitarian reports because it justified funding that the humanitarian agencies will receive. So I really do think they're actually very practical things that we can do as researchers to address some of these inequalities.
Maybe I can just jump in here. I think talking about methodologies and also the reflections that Marwan was, you know, provoking in terms of research practices, not only about ethics as well. It made me think a little bit about the first question in terms of maybe a question for all of us. How do you think, what are the challenges and opportunities of developing and supporting non-hegemonic ways of producing knowledge in relation to displacement? I think pretty much these questions of ethics and, you know, research practices come into that one. I would like to briefly share a reflection of our current research project that we really think align with non-hegemonic ways of producing knowledge, but actually it's pretty much inserted in hegemonic ways of like trying to conduct research. And I think we kind of see the tension nowadays of how we move forward. So as my colleague Gisela mentioned at the beginning of the pandemic, we came very much without funding, just a group of colleagues getting together, trying to understand the impacts of the pandemic and a refugee and migrant population in Latin America. And we start, you know, putting together a research agenda. We came out with a research protocol. At that time, we had ethical questions about conducting research with refugee and migrant population because of the situation they were living in the region. We decided to focus in other organizations instead. And really the process for me as a researcher was very illuminating in terms of working. You know, we were 12 people in a Zoom room, you know, having discussions all from different disciplines. And it was very enriching in terms of working together and really kind of, I think, saved for me the process of the pandemic, because it became a process, you know, a group of sorority and learning and also letting go in many cases, because we had very passionate discussions, all of us. And I've been reflecting lately about the possibilities of that type of research. Later on, we got some funding, but we started with no funding whatsoever. And we managed to still produce research to a particular personal cost. It was facilitated because we were working from home and we moved all our methodologies online and we were able to do this. But now that we have come back to the presentiality, you know, and being face to face and having all the commute and all the responsibilities that we have in the spaces where we work, has become increasingly more difficult for us to come together. We're still, you know, working together in the outputs from what we did in the next 2 years, but moving forward with an agenda we have discussed has become difficult, not having the funding to do so, and even finding the time. And I wonder how these spaces can survive when we are all in Latin America and here in the UK as well, guided by the same metrics of academia, you know, and scholarship in terms of where we publish, what funding we have, etc. You know, how we basically validate our knowledge production at the eyes of neoliberal academia. So I do wonder if any of you has any experience to share in that regard, or maybe something that you have done or anything that you can recommend. I think for us it's been very important in terms of putting this agenda together and working together, learning from each other, but actually just how to continue, you know, when we have all the pressures of being very much in certain academia, and also thinking about the privilege of why we've been able to do that, because despite that we are all in different career paths, you know, in terms of our career development, all of us had a secure employment at the time. And that made possible that we were able to engage in that research process that was completely unpaid. Just to put out there in terms you have, want to share anything about it.
May I just add one extra point to what Marcia has been saying? So going beyond the issue of the funding, right? The other difficulty that we have is gaining visibility for the knowledge we do produce, right? Because then we have, it's very difficult for us to continue to establish this South-North academic dialogue, or even with, you know, that industrial complex, the research or the humanitarian industrial complex, given that, you know, well, there's the outlets for putting out this knowledge is very much English and Northern dominated. One of the things that we actually discussed was, well, how can we socialize all this effort, all this research that we conducted during these 2 years, if we can't even pay for our staff to be open access? We just don't we don't even have money to employ, you know, research assistants, let alone pay £1,000 or £2,000 to have our knowledge put out there for a wider readership. So it's just, you know, we are at a loss here. This is the discussion that we are engaging in at the moment. So just wanted to talk about that, you know, prohibitively expensive nature of those open access journals, for instance, that complicates matters even further.
I think one more thing about journals that we have been discussing this as well with other colleagues in other contexts, when sometimes when the research is produced, you know, and thought about, and you know, from the local context, I feel that there's a request always to over justify why it's relevant to talk about Brazil, Colombia, Chile, you know, and Mexico. And I do wonder sometimes when I receive those comments, it's like, do they ask everybody publishing in the, you know, in the UK or in European context to justify what is that relevant? You know, why the context of Chile would be less important than what is happening in you know, in Europe at the moment. I think that's playing with the logics as well. It has changed a little bit, I think, in the last few years, and there are other outlets out there, but pretty much is something that is in the back of our minds as well.
Maybe I could just jump in on some of these points that I think, yeah, when we're when we're thinking about the need to, or how this work is being disseminated, I think it's also another reminder to question who is this research for and who is benefiting from it. And I'll go back to Marwan's point about when he talked about the incentive system within the refugee camps, which has differentiated pay depending on your nationality, on your status, and again, very different from an international aid worker's salary. And within the field that we work in, which is education and emergencies, there are countless studies on teachers' motivation in refugee education and teachers' well-being. There's hundreds of them. Yet there's very few that really talk about this issue of the stark pay inequalities between teachers, or the stark pay differences between an EIE consultant who could go and write a research paper or study on teachers' well-being and perhaps get paid more in a day or a week than many of the teachers get paid in a year. And so I think when we're thinking about the research that we're doing, that's another thing to consider. Who is it for? Who is benefiting from it? And how is this getting disseminated? For me, I mean, I can see, you know, maybe a more useful research in our field would be looking at how people unionize in camps. How do people do teacher strikes and push organizations to increase the incentive payments within places of campment? That would be critical insight for people who are also in other camps and need to use that knowledge for push for change. But I think it comes back to this idea about what is currently being produced, and maybe to move us towards thinking forward, if we are thinking about having these very different ways of knowing or kind of countering hegemonic narratives, we really need to think about again what we're producing and why we're producing it, and who ultimately is our audience. Is it the person who, are we there to support that person living in the camp, or are we there for dismissive about it, but are we there just to produce books and journals that actually many people can't access or engage with?
And I also say that I do understand what you mean, but I also think we should recognize that researchers, even those in the global north, are differentiated. So some will have more power than others. And I'm often not seen as very powerful in the global south because I'm a Black researcher. Some people don't expect me to have any access to resources, which I don't, namely. But there are all a sorts of assumptions made by people in the global south about my ability to leverage resources or power because I'm a Black researcher. But but that doesn't necessarily mean that I can't act in a decolonial way, because it also gives me access to spaces and hear conversations that might not be open to white researchers in various situations. But nevertheless, I do think we have privileges, and because of those privileges, whether we are white or Black, we can carry out research, or we can act in ways that could be much more supportive of the refugee communities. So, for example, you know, if you are doing research, and there, you know, I suppose like studying teacher strikes, one of the things I found was that the refugees in the community that refugee teachers weren't receiving their pensions. Right? They were constantly on temporary contracts, and only those two members of, you know, teachers who were on permanent contracts could get pensions. So I started to have those conversations with the Ministry of, you know, of Home Affairs, those responsible for refugees, with the international agencies as well. Although, I mean, I think they just fobbed me off probably, but at least we can start. You know, you can start those conversations, so that this is not just a matter for those who are in the settlements, who themselves are vulnerable. They'll protest, but there's a limit because there's always the danger that they could be sent, you know, forcibly repatriated across the border or expelled. So, yeah, we, you know, there's a geographer called Sarah Koopman who's written about this in relation to Latin America, where she talks about altered geopolitics and how, you know, in, especially she's a white North American, how you, our bodies, it's, you know, us and our the power and the positionality we have can actually be used effectively in support of in non-hegemonic ways if we think, you know, creatively about how we do so.
Going to jump in here, noting we have 8 minutes left, but just picking up on so Patricia's notion of acting in decolonial manner, for example, with some of the reflections on the instrumentalization of decolonialism as a discourse and the incomplete implementation of that within institutional frameworks. So Jennifer has shared a question in the chat bar, which is what people think about the term decolonization in the context of knowledge production and humanitarian action. Jennifer writes, the use of the term is obviously contested. It was set in question marks in the title of the event. So what do we think as about the term, and to what extent do we think that it's useful for our work? So Patricia's used it as in, with the caveat kind of in a decolonial manner, but saying that there is obviously a potentiality for something. Shall we each of us reflect on this and share a closing thought, or rather than a closing thought, a thought that we can carry forward as the conversations continue on these important questions. So who would like to start us off? Yusuf, I think you had some thoughts on the meaning of decolonialism and decolonization in this context.
Okay, I think perhaps what we need to acknowledge is that the term itself is not consumed as a reaction or as a reactive, perhaps, proposition to something that is there, because we have to ensure that within this or these decolonial frameworks, knowledge is produced, not just knowledge in response, but knowledge as in afresh. And this is perhaps what would take me also back to the refugee camp when we think about to production of knowledge. I think that we have to perhaps assume that it is a co-production of knowledge and co-sharing as well, where the refugee is not just the interviewee. The refugee can be also the analyst, the critical thinker, the theorist, not just the quotable, the person who features at times in a transience. So perhaps these are just brief thoughts on this.
I think there's obviously there's a lot of people who are quite keen to criticize the use of the term, and I think we should do in terms of especially where it's performative. But at the same time, I think the term has traction. There are also people who are very hostile towards it, and those tend to be establishment people who want to maintain the status quo. And because of their hostility, I think I need to continue using it and to actually operationalize it in a way that you know that actually bring about change. And I use the term, I'm not going to use the term emancipatory in quotes, that can bring about emancipatory change. So that's how I would use it. And that involves doing research that doesn't autonomize, you know, think about how we see the subject, the Western subject, right? You know, so can we not, you know, instead of just focusing on doing work that either commodifies or autonomize, you know, people and, you know, make them objectify them. I think we can think about what we mean by, I use decolonization actually with dehumanization. because I think the two are very are complementary, you know, because the colonial methods have been, colonial logics are about dehumanizing the research, dehumanizing us, dehumanizing the colonized. And if we are going to move away from those logics, then it's a process of humanizing. And that, therefore, it means solidarity, it means mutuality, it means thinking about work that will emphasize our common humanity.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Gisela, sorry, you go first.
Go on.
No, please. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you.
I just wanted to maybe, we have very few minutes, just following on to what Patricia said, I also find it very useful. And basically, I think one of our tasks or our responsibilities has to do with imbuing that in our research process, right? And also, this is the only way, or from where I stand, the only instrument or the only tool that I have at hand to give visibilities to these peoples, the people that we care about, that we center our research on. Nonetheless, I myself here feel like I'm swimming against the current, basically, because decolonizing is not pop around here, as it may, because the metrics employed to keep my job are or have been entirely colonized by the metrics of Northern academia. So I am being called to produce and to publish in those academic journals that, as I mentioned before, not only question why we matter to begin with, like Marcia said, but also we have a very hard time, socializing our research in these outlets. That's just wanted to complement that.
Thank you, Gisela. I have mixed feelings about the term, you know, decolonize and decolonization, but I do find that if it is relevant, as long as we use a reflexive decolonization approach in terms to recognize our own, you know, and unveiling our own complicity, either in colonial dominion over space or, you know, our being complicit as well in how we might reproduce hegemonic ways of, you know, humanitarian research and practice. So I think it's relevant in that regard, you know, to understand what decolonization entails and what it can be beyond, you know, being co-opted or marketized in particular way just to create new points for universities. So I think we could have a decolonial agenda in practice. And I think maybe that relates a little bit with Hussam's question as well in the chat in terms of how realistic is the assumption of the decolonization. I think Hussam, in the context of Latin America, as Gisela said, it's not an agenda that is particularly driven either by the organizations of government, maybe by academia, but actually I think it's really pushed by the refugees and migrants organizations themselves. Understanding that, of course, not every refugee or migrant is part of an organization, and there are many with completely different interests, but they have been pushing for a space at the table, not only to be invited to those spaces in particular way, but actually to be active, even in our spaces, recognizing, you know, the need for payment for researchers, if they're going to be researchers, but also being part of the discussions about migration governance, understanding that still their mobility and lives are determined by governance structures, you know, within and outside the territory, but at the same time that any policy that attain them, they want to be part of it. So I think that, it, you know, the reality is it's a difficult one, but I do think from the context that we study in particular, we can see how they have become very articulated and very, you know, they have branched out beyond the territory to actually use, for example, all the digital arenas in much smarter way to not only create local links, but also transnational links that have allowed them to claim different spaces. Thanks for the questions as well.
Thank you. Jess, you have the closing platform with Marwan, if you can share it with him somehow. Thank you.
Just to say that I think that it's useful as a prompt to start conversations and to start challenging this idea that we're living in a post-colonial world. But for me, I think the way it's currently being used is quite depoliticized, and as we've talked about today, and we've touched on this in at different points of the conversation, the systems that we're working in are embedded within certain practices in certain industrial complexes, which are working by design. And I think it's far more useful or productive for me when I'm thinking about these terms to think of the next logical step, which is moving more towards abolitionist thinking and thinking about how can we start to look at really, really dismantling these systems and structures that kind of exclude so many people and start thinking much more radically about what the possibilities are out there and kind of really stretch the kind of humanitarian imagination that way. Unfortunately, Marwan Khan has been unable to join us for the end of the closing session, but I will share these reflections with him and this, of course, the recording as well.
Thank you so much. I'm sure all the audience members will join me in thanking our speakers for sharing their critical perspectives with us today. Sorry that we've run over a couple of minutes, but in addition to having the recording, which we'll be able to share with Marwan, we'll be posting Marwan's full podcast on the Southern Responses to Displacement website. We also, with thanks to the UCL Institute of Advanced Studies, have funding to translate an edited version of our transcript today into Spanish and Arabic to take a small step towards ensuring that such materials are more openly accessible to a wider range of audiences. And as I mentioned, this is part of an ongoing conversation, which will, amongst other things, take us towards a round table in a special issue of an open access journal. And there will be many other opportunities, I'm sure, to continue both as part of this project and of many others, such important reflections and perspectives moving forwards. So thank you all. We will be keeping a note of your questions and your comments in the chat bar, as well as our panelists write up their critical reflections for the journal. So thank you to all for an excellent roundtable. I'm looking forward to continuing these conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Elena, for organizing this forum.
Thank you very
much. You're very welcome. Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Great to meet you, Jess, as well, and Patricia, and you, Sip.
See you.